week's Parsha, Parsha's Chukah, starts off with one of the stranger laws of Paraduma. Paraduma is always strange. Everything about it is strange, that you're supposed to take something, when you're Tame, you're supposed to take a red cow, shecht it, burn it, right? Then take the ashes, mix it in with water, and then sprinkle it on the person every third and seventh day, and that somehow makes a person Tahor. Nobody understood this law except for Moshe Rabbeinu. Even Shlomo Melech did everything he could in order to understand it and couldn't get anything. But one of the most, let's just call it enigmatic laws that come together with it, is the following word. It says, when a satam usal alazar kohen, you should give it over to alazar kohen, behotzi usal mihutz amachana, you should bring it out of the camp, this is the paraduma, the red heifer, the shachat usal lefanav, and you have to shacht it in front of the Lazar HaKohen. You have to shecht it in front of him. If he's not there, the whole thing is puzzled. And then it goes on. As it goes on, Lazar takes it and whatever it is, and they burn it. Again, Sarfas Apara Le'enov. He has to stand there watching it. Unless via Lazar HaKohen, he did the Kohen Gadol at the time. And he's got to be standing there watching it as Orav, as Bisarv, as Damal, Pirshe Yisroel. Everybody's to be standing there watching it. What in the world does the guy have to stand there for? Why would the guy have to watch it the whole time? It should just be that it's good enough for them to hear about it. Why is that necessary? So the Gan Rav tells us an answer, but he gives two introductions to be able to understand it. Number one, the 40 years that Bnei Yisrael were in the desert for, during all those 40 years, they had the ability to see like Superman. With X-ray vision, they could see what was going on inside of jars, inside of cups, inside of different places. They were able to look inside and see what was going on. They could see everything without it being clear whatsoever. Why did they have that? See, the light that came from the Anani HaKavod was a powerful, penetrating light. It had the ability for them to see things that they wouldn't have seen normally. In fact, the mun that they ate was good enough that when they looked at a person after eating the mun, they could tell if he was lying or not. You just looked at the person, you could tell, was he lying? Was he kidding? What was he doing? You were able to tell everything just by looking at the person. You were able to penetrate. You were able to see in exactly what was going on from this type of a thing. So if the man had that and everybody had that, you were able to see anything you wanted. Okay? You could see anything. Number two, the concept of rov is learned from the paraduma. Now what's the concept of the rov? That we go with the majority. Now why is that? The paraduma has to be shechted while it's whole. You cannot make any cuts in the skin whatsoever. And then after it's shechted, you take the entire animal and you burn it in a fire and you turn it into ashes. Now the problem is that the paraduma has to be a perfect animal without any blemishes. Cannot have a single blemish on it. But how are you going to be able to tell? You can't tell. It's already burned into ashes. What are you going to do to be able to tell to tell you if it's going to be perfect or not? Right there, you have a major problem that there's no way to find out. You can't figure it out. There's no way you can be able to do. How can you assume that it's a kosher cow? The answer is, says the Gemara, you go with rove. You go with the majority. You go with the majority in that the majority of cows are kosher. And if the majority of cows don't have any problem, we have to assume that this cow is kosher. However, we only go with rove if you can't figure it out in any other way. If there's any other way to figure it out, then you got to figure it out in some other way. Well, in the Midbar, there was another way to figure it out. What was the other way of figuring it out? X-ray. Use your X-ray vision to be able to look at the animal to see if it was kosher or not. So that's exactly why Elazar, who knew how to use the light correctly, had to stand there watching when the animal was shechted and when the animal was burned to make sure that the animal was entirely kosher. Because he didn't want to rely on rove. He wanted to look at it and see with his X-ray vision, was he going to see something in this animal or not? Is this animal kosher or not? He looked in, stared at it, found whether or not it was kosher, and when he saw that it was kosher, he was able to say, this is the only animal. You should know, as a side note, there was a total of 11 paradumas that were ever shechted and burned for Klal Yisrael. 11 altogether. This paraduma of Moshe Rabbeinu lasted for the next 850 years. They did not have a second one until the times of Ezra HaKohen, Ezra HaSofer, in the second base of Mikdash. These ashes are amazing. Not only were they just never left, they kept coming back, but you were able to just pour more water on, and they sprinkled however many people needed to be sprinkled per day, per week, per month, whatever it was, and they were able to do it, and it just kept going and going and going. It's an unbelievable little thing. The second thing that we have to talk about is that right after the Paraduma, which takes up the beginning of the Parsha, we immediately go into the death of Miriam. Miriam, the only woman according to the Amorites, to ever die in the Midbar. 40 years in the desert, you have one woman dying, and it's Miriam, according to the Amorites, and she dies right here after the Paraduma. So the immediate question is, why in the world is Miriam put next to the Paraduma? Why are you putting her right next to there? No cow jokes, it's not a good thing. Why would you put her right there? It's a silly thing to be able to do. So Rashi says it straight out, and it's very easy. The answer is that the Paraduma was a kapara, an atonement for Klal Yisrael, an atonement for Bnei Yisrael, and so too, when a tzaddik dies, the misa of a tzaddik is also machaper for Klal Yisrael. The death of a tzaddik can be machaper, can atone for everybody in Bnei Yisrael, and we learn that from the juxtaposition, good art school word, between the Paraduma and Miriam's death. You have that right next to each other. You got it right next to each other. That's the reason why it's a kapara that's telling us this. The problem is...
That was a question on Jeopardy yesterday.
It was juxtaposition or art school. It's one of the two. So what's it? What is it? What's this guy?
Juxtaposition.
I think it's kind of sad that you... Okay, anyway, we're not going to go into the fact that you watch Jeopardy. I have a question for you. Paraduma is machaper? Paraduma is machaper for what? Paraduma has nothing to do with kapara. The Paraduma makes you tahor from Tumas Meis. If your tame, it throws it on you, and you're not machaper, there's no atonement. It's just somehow magically, all of a sudden you become poof, you're a tahor person. That's all it is. There's no kapara. If you want to get a kapara, put the death of Miriam right next to the Korban Chatas. The Korban Chatas is for sin, it's a sin offering, where automatically you get a kapara. Put it next to there, that would be an atonement. But putting it over here by the red heifer, why in the world would you put it here over anything else? Says the Ksav Sofer, a brilliant answer. A korban needs three things to do what it's supposed to do. Three things altogether. Number one, wine libations. And that's back in Parshas Shlach that we said before. They need wine libations. Now that's represented by a tzaddik's death. Because by a tzaddik's death, you also have libations. The libations are the tears. The tears of the people that are sitting at his funeral. When they cry, that's as if there's a wine libation. A wine libation given over to a Kaddish Baruch. You're crying for that tzaddik. And by the way, I know it's a little, you are supposed to cry when a big tzaddik passes away. Whether you're at the funeral or not, you are supposed to cry. It's considered one of the holiest things that a person can do, and if a person does it, it can take care of a lot of terrible things that can happen to a person otherwise. Crying at his funeral, that's how great it is. Just saying this side note, if you don't know how to cry, all you have to really do is think of The Lion King. I think we've all watched it at some point in our lives, and remember that. Or watch any Disney movie, really, where the parents die, because all of them are going to die at some point. Just remember one of those scenes in the Bambi. I mean, just think of anything. Any movie, you either know that the parents are dead or they're going to die. It's much worse when they start off with the parents because you know someone's going to die. I don't think there is a Disney movie that doesn't have death of, you know, or an orphan. I don't think there is.
Basically, you're promoting watching movies now. On tape. I just want to know that Rabbi T. Zimmerman says that you should watch movies. That's all I'm saying. He pops gonna say,
I'm from now on, I take back everything I said. That's not there. But we all know that in the olden days, we all did at one point, and now we're all Bali Chuba who would never do that ever again. And therefore, because of that, so obviously, you're supposed to cry. That's number one. Number two, second thing is, thank you, Dave. Second thing is, both a korban and the misa of a tzaddik needs chuba in order for the atonement to happen.
And Bambi.
If you don't do chuba, Bambi's mom. Tshuva is the second thing that's absolutely required. You need to have tshuva, and you need to do something about it. You have to absolutely repent when that happens, and that's one other thing that needs to happen by both, the misa of a tzaddik or by a korban. If you don't do it, it doesn't work. And number three, and one of the bigger ones, the korban must be shechted only in a holy place. Now in that, the paraduma is not so. The paraduma is brought outside the camp. The paraduma is burned outside the walls. It can't be done in the Beis HaMikdash. It must be done outside the Beis HaMikdash. It has to be done in an unholy place. In a place that's in the middle of nowhere, there's no other place to do it. And that's the similarity between a paraduma and the misa of a tzaddik. The death of a tzaddik does not have to be that it only happens in Yerushalayim that you cry for him. It only happens that it's a kapara. The kapara of the death of a tzaddik can happen anywhere. Even if it's in a concentration camp, even if it's in anywhere, you know, anywhere, it can happen that the misa of a tzaddik allows for a kapara. And that's why you put the two together. Now let's think. The truth is, the paraduma's power to make you tahor lies in the fact that it extends kedusha. It brings holiness outside to areas where kedusha does not go. Yeah.
I thought the reason that Miriam was nifter is because she spoke Lashon Hara about mushroom.
That is true. 100%.
Right. So but in addition, it was a kapara.
How many people die for Lashon Hara? I mean, that's the idea, that how many people actually do die for the Lashon Hara that they speak. Miriam was able to be a kapara for that.
I don't know if it's all for Lashon Hara, but 100% of people definitely die.
You're definitely true. But for the Lashon Hara that they spoke, Miriam had one sin, and therefore that.
And of course, if she had not spoken, she would have lived forever?
No, she would have been able to go inside Eretz Yisrael. And maybe that's the answer to your question also. She would have at least gone inside Eretz Yisrael. The reason why she died here, as opposed to dying in Eretz Yisrael, would have been that. But the truth is, that is the Paraduma's power. Its Kedusha extends out. It applies to someone who's Tameh. And that's the idea of the death of a Tzaddik as well. The death of a Tzaddik causes an atonement for everyone, even those that don't deserve it. Even those that are Tameh. Even those people that don't get it, that don't understand it, and don't want it. It doesn't matter that Tzaddik Kapara would happen. And that's the idea behind it, and that's why we put the two together, Parah Aduma together with Miriam. That's the idea behind it. Now, there is a line that it mentions a little bit earlier by the Parah Aduma where it says, the famous line that everybody uses is that a person should, of course I can't find it now, that a person should, when a person dies in a tent, he becomes tummy for 7 days. So we compare Torah to the death when the person dies in a tent, says Rashi. And the idea is, the only way to acquire Torah is to kill yourself over it. To literally kill yourself over it. To that, Chazal all asked the exact same question. But I thought, v'chai b'hem. You can't die for Torah, it's v'chai b'hem. You should live with the laws of the Torah. What does it mean to die through the Torah itself? So you gotta get to the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim gives this, he compares this idea to a rich man. Okay, there's a rich man.
Isn't one of the three things that you got to bow together?
There are three things, but not for Torah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not for Torah itself. That you don't do. Okay, he is a rich man. He owns a massive Walmart. Now, I will tell you, the Chafetz Chaim was not talking about a Walmart, but I don't think many of us understand the concept of, you know, tailors or things like that back then. So, a rich man owned a massive Walmart. He was always busy. Always dealing with people that were giving him.
Owns a massive Walmart?
Owns a massive Walmart.
Pretty sure
always busy.
The Walmart family.
We're just saying. Always working. That's a specific one.
He might have been
a
yid, I don't know.
My gosh,
Walter.
You got me.
Walter, right?
Wow. You just threw out the whole mushel. I don't know what to do now. I guess I have no parable. Thank you. He owns a Walmart, okay? I don't know how. I never asked. I didn't ask. The guy owned a Walmart. That's just what happened. He was always working. He was always busy. Never had a time to rest. Never had a time to do anything. And he finally decided enough was enough. The guy got up one day and he said enough is enough. He knew he was going to die soon. He knew he had to prepare himself for his final days. He had to prepare himself. So the very next day, he spent an hour after davening. Went to davening early in the morning. Spent an hour after davening just sitting in the base medrash and learning. He finished afterward, and his face was glowing. Now, his wife knew that he was gone for an extra hour, couldn't understand where he went. She said, it's an anomaly. It happens once in a while. My husband will, whatever, go somewhere. It's not that big of a deal. But then it happened again, and again, and again. Eventually, his clients were wondering, where in the world is he going? His workers were wondering, why in the world is he coming so late? And he was coming an hour late, an hour and a half late, 2 hours late, and soon he wasn't coming till the middle of the day. So finally, she said, I got to get to the bottom of this. She starts following him. She realized that right after davening, he sits down, and he starts learning with a chavrusa, pulls out a Gemara, and he's sitting there for hours on end learning Gemara with the chavrusa. She goes in and she says, what? Did you go crazy? What's going on? You have a whole store to take care of. You have clients that are waiting for you. You have workers that are waiting for you. Nobody knows what to do. You're the one who has to tell them what to do. What are you doing? Why are you sitting in shul? And he said to her, I want you to think this way. He said to his wife, he said, imagine if the Malach Mavis came to me right now. Malach Mavis came to me right now and said, it's time for you to go. You think I'd be able to say to him, I've got clients in my store and I've got workers and I've got everybody else there? You think that's going to knock out the Malach Mavis? He said, but you think that's going to knock out the Malach Mavis? So, no, it's not. Consider it, he said, as if I'm dead. Now you should know the Chafetz Chaim himself got a huge inheritance at one point. Huge. I mean, for him it was huge. He was a very, very, very poor man at the beginning of his life. And he decided to use the inheritance to buy a store. His wife ended up buying the store and she ended up taking care of the whole store. Now there were times where the store was very busy and she really needed some help. And she sent a message to the Chafetz Chaim, who at the time was still younger. He was learning in a base medrash somewhere. She sent a message to him and said, please come help me. I need a little bit of help in the store. Now I know by all of us, we all think, okay, that's that. Chafetz Chaim is the Chafetz Chaim. He sent her a message and said back to her and said, I want you to imagine as if I was dead and I can't help you. There's nothing I can do. Again, I don't know if I would be able to do this, but I'm not the Chofetz Chaim, and I didn't write the Mishnah Berurah and the Shemir Zalosh. Okay, that's out there.
If you don't come back to the turn, you will be dead.
His wife wrote that. His wife. And that's why the Chofetz Chaim's Revitzin is the Chofetz Chaim's Revitzin, and the Revitzin said, okay. That's what the Chofetz Chaim used to say.
So
and this is the concept.
Is not...
But yes, I'm going to say not like the rest of the other time. Again, we've got me on tape twice already so far. Yeah, again.
Movies and what else are we doing?
Yeah, what? Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's exactly
I like
it.
I like this.
Yeah, this is a brand new movie. Brand new. Right, right. Well, we're only watching Disney movies on Shabbos. That's exactly what we're doing. Number two, but number three, and this story is a true story. This actually happened. Another man who got up one day and decided he's going to have nothing to do with his business anymore. Literally woke up in the morning, was going to have nothing to do with it. His sons, who all worked for him, all of his sons came up to him and said, Ted, what are you doing? Come with us to work. We have to go work. And he said, absolutely not. He said, listen, we don't mind if you sit and learn all day. Obviously, we're okay with that. But just help us learn the business a little bit better. Allow us to get a little bit more into it. Introduce us to your clients so we know what we're doing. We're not going into it completely blind. Father said, absolutely not. The clients start calling off. Listen, we'll do business with your children, but we need you to be involved. We don't know them yet. We don't trust your kids. You have to be involved. The guy said, absolutely not. Stop talking to me. They started asking him over the week, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Just get his advice. What does he think about this part of the business, about that part of the business? The guy refused to answer anything. He just sat and learned the entire time. It's an absolutely true story. Just sat and learned the entire time. It took a while, but the kids eventually got the hang of it. They ended up figuring out what part they should get into and what part they all specialized in. They all got it. And at the end of the day, they said, all right, look, that's that. The father ended up becoming this massive Talmud Chacham. As years passed, the family became extremely prosperous. I mean, the kids made more money than the father ever did. And the father was this massive Talmud Chacham that everybody was impressed with, and the children were so proud of their father that learned. And they all said to him, they got up one day, years later, maybe even decades later, and they said to their father, listen, we don't argue with what you did. You clearly did the right thing, right, with how you handled it and what you did, but just tell us, how do you know this is going to work out? How did you know? So he said, that morning, I was about to leave to go to our business, and I overheard the Rav say that a person has to kill himself over Torah. That Adam Kiyamos Ba'olel, that a person has to literally kill himself when it comes to Torah. And I said to myself, the only way for me to acquire Torah at my age, at the time it was very old, the only way for me to do this is if I literally spend all my time. I'd literally do everything I can to make it as if I'm dead. Make it as if I'm dead. So I couldn't answer any of your questions because then I wouldn't be dead. I couldn't get involved in the business because then I wouldn't be dead. I wanted to acquire the Torah, and I knew that the only way for me to acquire it is to pretend as if I'm dead. And it worked. Now, again, I don't suggest this to everybody out there, but if you really try this, then that's a way to acquire Torah like nobody else. You literally consider it as if you're dead. The Torah doesn't want you to kill yourself over Torah. That's not the idea, to literally die over the Torah that you're learning. That's not the idea. The Chaybam, you have to live. There are three things you have to kill yourself for. There are certain times where you have to kill yourself for. But for the most part, the Torah is saying, L'chaibam, you should live in them. It should be something that's good for you, not something that's a negative for you. But there are times, in order for it to be good for you, where you have to look at it as if everything else in the world is nothing to you. As if you're dead from the rest of the things in the world. And that's the only way that it's going to be there, and it's not going to work any other way. But we don't have that much time. We're going to go a little bit more over here. It said the following. Bnei Yisrael had a really interesting complaint. Miriam passed away, and they wanted water. There was no water. The water, the air, so Miriam went away. So they said, they gathered on Moshe Aaron. They said, what's with the water? If only we would have died before. Why do you bring us to the desert to kill us and our animals? Why do you bring us up from Egypt? To this place, this evil place. It's a place where we don't have grain, we don't have figs, we don't have grapes, we don't have pomegranates, and we don't have water. What was their complaint? Where did the fruit come in? Fruit and grain? I don't understand. They still have the mun. The mun is still there. That wasn't a problem. There was no one there that didn't have mun. The mun, the food, was not the issue. The fruits was not an issue. The problem was that they didn't have anything to drink. Their first claim should have been, we don't have any water. And by the way, I could also use an apple. That's another thing. But to start off and say we don't have grapes, you don't have figs, you don't have pomegranates, and then say you don't have any water? That's ridiculous. It's the wrong claim to make. Right. What were Bnei Yisrael doing? And then aside from that, when Moshe Rabbeinu, what? If only we had that, 100%. But then Moshe Rabbeinu, when he answers them back, he hits the rock, we know, instead of speaking to the rock, and he gives them water. And there's no figs, no pomegranates, no anything. He didn't answer their claim. Their claim was, we want fruit, and they didn't get the fruits. They got water, but they didn't get the fruits. So why did they bring it up in the first place if they didn't really care about the fruits in the first place? Now you could say the easy answer is that once you start complaining, complaints start rolling in. But the Torah wouldn't mention those complaints unless it was important. So what is it? You know what we learn from here? It's a Gemara. Rabbi Akiva says, you are not allowed to live in a town that does not have fresh fruits and vegetables. Not allowed to live in such a town. Why? Because fruits and vegetables help you become a healthy person. And without fruits and vegetables, you cannot become a healthy person. So you need to have fruits and vegetables around. That's what you need to have. Says the Gemara. But the Be'er Shomerim also healed people. You know there's a Ramah that says you should drink well water on Motzei Shabbos. Why? Because the Be'er Shomerim, although it's no longer with us, the Be'er Shomerim appears in well water every Motzei Shabbos. And if you drink from well water that is drawn on Motzei Shabbos, you have the ability to have the Be'er Shomerim, which makes you healthy, says the Ramah. This is the Halacha. This is in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, that says that you should go ahead and drink well water on Motzei Shabbos because it makes you healthy. If you have well water from Be'er Shomerim, then you have health. So here's what the Bnei Yisrael said. We no longer have the Be'er Miriam because Miriam's gone. If we don't have the Be'er Miriam, then we need to be healthy. If we need to be healthy, then Rabbi Akiva Paskins, we can't live here because there's no fruit here. So either give us fruit or do something else because we can't live in this area because we're not going to become healthy. So what ended up happening? Moshe Rabbeinu brought them back Be'er Miriam, the well of Miriam. He brought back Be'er Miriam. You don't need the fruits to be healthy anymore, and then you're okay. That's the idea behind Halavai for us all, that we shouldn't need the vegetables and the fruits to be able to become healthy. Just have the little bit of water, and that would be awesome, except for maybe potatoes and strawberries. Those I can live with. And maybe even green beans. I'm okay with green beans also. Potato is a vegetable. It goes in the same. Strawberries also are vegetables, technically. I'm also with that. I'm okay with certain fruits. That's okay. But salads, you don't make friends with salads. We all know that. That's not going to happen, right? Yeah, but even with dressing. I mean, it has to be a strawberry dressing, but it's not strawberry. It's very, very hard. Very, very hard. We're going to get to. Okay. One more board. We're going to end with this one. We're going to end with what the sin was. After all this is when we have the Nachash and Nechoshet, a really crazy thing where these snakes were biting them, and they ended up making this copper snake and putting it up on top of a pole. Toward the end of the parsha, they start traveling, and this is where they fight against Og and Sichon, the two massive giants, and Moshe Rabbeinu was able to defeat them both. He's scared of Og, but he's able to jump up and defeat Og. A tremendous. The rest of the parsha is unbelievable as well. But we have to understand, what exactly was Moshe Rabbeinu's problem? What did he do wrong? What did he do wrong with hitting the rock? Obviously, he had his reasons. There's no question that he had his reasons and his ideas behind it. And the previous years, Og is a different issue. Og is a different issue altogether. It's because he served Avram Avinu. But over here, there's got to be something. I mean, we've talked about we've had at least 12 or 13 answers as to what happened with Mei Meribah over the past few years, about 5-6 years that we've had these shirim. We've had at least 12 or 13 answers. I just saw Ksav Sofer this year, and it goes the exact opposite of the way everybody else learns. Literally the exact opposite. Everybody quotes the Rambam. The Rambam says the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu was punished over here when he hit the rock is because he got angry. When you get angry, you end up being able to do things that you shouldn't have done. How do we know he got angry? Because he said to Bnei Yisrael, Shimuna Amorim, listen please, O rebellious people. Listen, O rebellious people. Right? From this rock will I be able to bring out water for you. And he got so angry, something happened, and he hit the rock instead. The Ramban argues, the Rashi argues, lots of people argue on the Rambam, but that's the Rambam's shot. Says the Ksav Sofer, let me explain to you what the Rambam means. And this is an unbelievable verse. When was the last time when you're really angry that you said the word please? When do you do that? So because of that, Art Scroll does not translate it as please. He translates it as now. Listen now, O rebellious people. I think the O is an O. Listen now, O rebels. Listen now, O rebels. But no, we all know, does mean the word please. Who says the word please when you're angry? Now please listen to me now. It doesn't happen. So what did he mean by that? Here's the pshat. Moshe Rabbeinu never got angry over his own honor being destroyed. when his own honor was taken down, Moshe Rabbeinu was always okay with it. Because Moshe, who is he? He's a humble person. Even when his brother and sister talk about him in front of his face and start yelling at him and calling him a Rasha and doing things to him, nonetheless, even at that moment, Moshe Rabbeinu does not say a thing. Hashem has to get up in front and do something instead. There's only one time where Moshe Rabbeinu gets up and he yells and he gets angry and he screams. Only one time. When does he get angry? He gets angry when Bnei Yisrael say something about God. When they go up against God, that's when Moshe Rabbeinu gets angry and goes up against them. When Korach wasn't arguing on Moshe and Aaron, Moshe understood that. Korach was going up against God. We're not doing anything God wants us to do. And when that happens, that's when Moshe Rabbeinu says, God, we can't have this here. That's when he gets angry. It opens up a spot in the ground. That's when he starts going crazy, and that's what happens. Over here, Bnei Yisrael were saying, why didn't God just kill us over there? What's going on with the Bereshit Miriam? They're arguing not on Moshe Rabbeinu's power, but on God's ability to give them water in the middle of the desert. What are we supposed to do? We're all going to die. All of our children are going to die. How could he do that? Because they were arguing with God, what should Moshe Rabbeinu have done? He should have gotten up, slapped them all in the face, punched them all, maybe in the gut, and said to them, how could you say that about God? What's wrong with you for saying that about a cursed Baruch Hu? He didn't get angry enough. He got angry, but he didn't give the right amount of anger. He should have given them more Musar. He should have yelled at them more. The fact that he lowered it and said, please listen to me, O rebellious people. If you're going to be angry, if you're going to yell at them, yell at them. And tell them what they did wrong. Don't just say, please listen for a second, guys. You guys are being rebellious right now. That is not the way you do it when they're arguing on Hashem. If they're arguing on you, okay. Then you go ahead and give them Musar in a soft manner. Guys, that's not the way to speak. That's not the way to do it. When they're going up against the Kodesh Baruch Hu in this way, this is when you have to show your anger. And it's the opposite. They deserve the thrashing. He should have given it to them. His punishment was for being too nice in this situation. That's what the Rambam meant. The Rambam meant that he was getting punished for being angry, says the Ksav Sofer. He's medayik, according to the wording in the Rambam. He's getting punished for not being angry enough. And that's the idea behind it. That is why it was called Mei Meriva, waters of the fights. Meaning, he should have fought Bnei Yisrael. And that's why it says that Sharavu was Hashem, that they fought with God. Since they fought with God, Bnei Yisrael should have been yelled at. When they weren't, that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was punished for. So let's just go through a little bit. We said why Lefanav, why Elazar had to be there for the Parah Aduma being shechted, to see what was going on inside. We said the Parah Aduma compares to the death of Miriam, that they're both kaparas, they're both atonements. Atonement as in bringing the Tahara to the place of Tuma, to the place of impurity. Number three, the Chai Bahem, that a person, in order to understand Torah, has to imagine himself as if he were dead, or put himself in a position to think of himself as if he's dead. The no fruits idea, that we said that even though there weren't going to be any fruits, they wouldn't need it if they had the Bereshit Miriam. And finally, the Ksav Sofer saying Moshe Rabbeinu's punishment was because he didn't get angry enough. He should have gotten more angry at Bnei Yisrael, and that's what he should have done. We'll stop with that, guys. Have a great Shabbos.